Well, good afternoon. It is about 34 minutes past the hour of 12 o'clock. You're listening to KFSK Petersburg. I'm Hannah Flohr, and it is time for PMC Live. That is our call-in show with healthcare officials here in Petersburg. And today we have live in Studio One, Phil Hofstetter, CEO. And I don't have your mic on yet, Phil. I'm sorry.
How's that?
There we go. CEO of Petersburg Medical Center. And we're also joined by Brandy Boggs, patient navigator at Petersburg Medical Center.
Hello.
Is that still your title?
That is still my title.
Okay, just confirming. And then we are joined on the phone by Jared Kosin. Jared, do you hear me?
I do hear you. Thank you for having me today.
Yeah, absolutely. And Jared is the CEO of Alaska Hospital Healthcare Association. That's a nonprofit trade association that represents and supports Alaska's hospitals and nursing homes and other healthcare partners around the state. And I wanted to start out, we're going to be talking a lot about the potential cuts to Medicaid, federal cuts, and other healthcare programs that could potentially affect people here in Petersburg and around the state. A little bit of background. On Tuesday night, the U.S. House passed a budget with about $2 trillion in spending cuts, and some of that could potentially impact Medicaid and other healthcare programs, about $880 billion over the decade would be cut to the committee that handles healthcare spending. That includes Medicaid. It's not a done deal. They have to work with the Senate to reconcile two different budgets, but we just wanted to talk a little bit about what those cuts could potentially look like here in Petersburg and around Alaska. I know there's a lot of unknowns. I talked to you yesterday, Phil, and you were like, we don't know. We don't know. Yeah, we don't know. We don't know. But to start off with, I'm curious, do we have, I know that 27 million people rely on Medicaid nationwide. I'm curious, do we have numbers for Petersburg? Do we have numbers for Alaska in terms of how many people rely on Medicaid?
Yeah, I'm still getting the numbers locally, but I'm thankful for Jared coming on because he has the more current information from the statewide impacts. And I think it's one out of every three or something. But Jared, do you want to comment on that?
Yeah, it is. Thanks, Phil. It is one out of every three Alaskans, generally speaking, is on Medicaid. So I think the answer is right around 250,000. And we might be off on that. I'm going off the cuff. But that's in the neighborhood for what Medicaid covers.
Okay. And just a quick, you know, I know that in the past I have confused Medicaid and Medicare. Let's establish what that is. Medicaid is the health insurance that covers low-income people.
Yeah, it's a state. It's the state version, and Medicare is federal. But they, as you know, as we're learning, right, as everyone is learning, it interchanges quite a bit. So it's part of the CMS, which is the Center for Medicaid and Medicaid, at the federal level. So, and there's a whole formula that I think is what's makes it very complicated.
Yeah, and you said that Medicaid is the state healthcare, but it's partially paid by the federal government and partly paid by the state governments. I think 50-50.
It depends on the service, and that's what makes it confusing. Like the Affordable Care Act or expansion has a different rate, 90% federal, 10% state, and there's 50-50 for the general Medicaid, and then there's different variations. And I think, Jared, you have probably more detail or specifics on that one.
Yeah, isn't it amazing, Hannah, answering a pretty basic question and it already gets complicated. But generally speaking, just like you said, this is a stereotypical way of looking at it. It's not correct, but when you think of Medicare, you think of our older population. When you think of Medicaid, you think of our poorer population. Again, I'm just going to keep it that simple. It's not. But on the Medicaid side, Phil's correct. Generally speaking, the federal government is going to pay 50% of what it costs to administer Medicaid coverage in Alaska. The state's going to pay the other 50%. But then there are different populations within that where the state will pay less and the federal government will pay more.
Okay. And I'm curious, you know, this is for lower income people. If folks aren't low income, why should they be concerned about these cuts, these potential cuts?
Yeah. Phil, if you mind, where I come from in my chair and my kind of role in the state is I have more of a broader statewide perspective on these issues, and so I'm very aware, you know, it looks different in different areas, especially Petersburg. But, you know, to answer your question, it's not just low-income people. You know, we're also talking children. Lots of Alaskan kids are born and go on to Medicaid. We're also talking about people with complex needs. So there are other populations within this. So it's not as simple as just your income defines it. But the other thing I would say as well with that is Medicaid covers, we said earlier, 1 in 3, you know, generally right around there, people are on Medicaid. If you drastically cut Medicaid coverage for that 1 out of every 3 Alaskans, then they no longer have health care coverage. And so when they go to use the health care resources in our state, it actually just drives up costs for everybody because they no longer have an insurer or any type of coverage to help pay for those costs. So it has a direct effect on everybody.
Talk a little bit more about that. So it's not necessarily that the people who are uninsured because they don't have Medicaid anymore would not get the health care. They could potentially still get some health care. That cost would just be distributed to other people. How would that work? How does that cost distribution work?
Yeah, you know, you're sitting with Phil right now, and he's the perfect person to illustrate this. But when someone doesn't have health care coverage and you're in trouble and you're really sick or you're really hurt, what do? You're going to go to the emergency room because that's what's available to you. And hospital emergency rooms will always serve you. We're required by law to do so. And so regardless of whether you have coverage or not, you're essentially getting, if you don't have coverage, we're essentially funneling you to the only place you can get care, and that's an emergency room, which is the highest cost environment to receive medical care. And so we'd be driving up overutilization of emergency room services, which again, none of that would be covered, none of it would be paid for. So then Phil and his hospital in Petersburg would be serving a lot more people and not be receiving any payment for it. And that's going to put substantial pressure on his budget and ability to even stay open.
Phil, you're nodding.
Yeah. Yeah. I actually analyzed this data for when expansion happened. And a few years ago, even, and testified on it at the Senate level in 2019, I think. And what was interesting was that, when people were off of Medicaid, didn't have Medicaid at the time, there was no expansion, no Medicaid, the cost of one person who with complex needs that came into the inpatient and in the ER ended up being 4 times the amount when they actually got coverage and then went into the clinic and got services that they need. And that was universal across not large numbers of patients that came into our facility that fell in that category.
You're saying it costs 4 times as much to give people care in an emergency setting than it would be to give them care before it reaches that emergency?
Yeah, it's not just the emergency. Emergency then goes to an admission. So then they're coming to the emergency and then they're in our inpatient stay. And it doesn't end there. Sometimes, which I'm not even, you know, my data ends there. But then what it could happen and often does is they need a higher level of service than their medevac. And if you want to talk about the single biggest cost in healthcare in Alaska is medevacs. Mm. And so when we start talking about cost of care and keeping costs, I talk about this all the time and keeping costs, close to home, keeping care, talk about prevention, going into the clinic, you know, not going to the ER, those kinds of things, having established physicians here, primary care physicians, all that is the same argument. The argument is keeping people out of the ER and inpatient, keeping good health care, keeping them and preventing them from coming into those services. That's the most expensive service in health care. And then it just goes higher. You get medevac, and then you go to a tertiary care facility, higher level care, Providence or regional, and then the rate's even higher. So that there's a huge trickle or, cascade of events that mm-hmm. occurs.
So just to make sure I'm understanding this right, if somebody comes in to the emergency room and doesn't have insurance, you will still treat them. And if they need to be medevaced, they will still get medevaced and they will get sent to a different hospital for that tertiary care. And none of that cost will be able to be recouped because there is no insurance to bill. Is that right?
Yeah. Yes.
Yep.
Yep.
So in expanding on that too. So if you think about it, if you're sick, you know, where do we want you to go ideally? Do you want to go start with primary care, or do you want to go straight to the emergency room in medevac? The answer is always going to be primary care, right? Unless it's a true emergency. And a primary care visit is far more cost effective than being medevaced. And so when we start talking about cuts to Medicaid and people no longer having Medicaid, well, if you don't have coverage, then you don't get to go to primary care. And so you're automatically going to the more expensive environment, all of which, as you just illustrated, is not paid for. Mm-hmm. And so it's just driving up healthcare costs, and those costs get absorbed everywhere throughout the healthcare system.
I was going to ask about that. So then if you have increased costs because you have these uninsured people who are coming to the emergency room more, mm-hmm. then you are going to have to start charging more for other services at the hospital. Is that right, Phil?
Yeah, I mean, it gets a little complicated because I'm not even thinking about that. You know what I'm thinking about?
What?
The burnout of staff. Because mm-hmm. what ends up happening, bar none, especially in a rural community, is that you start burning your staff out really fast. And then you talk about cost of care just goes up and goes up. And then then we're just staffing ER. And then we're not talking about, you know, primary care at all, maybe, you know, that kind of stuff.
And the cost goes up when staff are burnt out because you have to train new people, you have to hire new people, there's not enough people to go around.
You're on call, you're taking care of people in the middle of the night. Those burdens are really, there's a fine line with those burdens. And when that happens, you know, over and over again consecutively, nurses and doctors just don't want to be part of that system. And there's definitely a huge burnout factor when it comes to things like that, in addition to the costs. And then that drives the costs even higher, you know. Of course, and then the burden gets shifted to the commercial payers, and then our premiums go up. You know, this is really, you know, there's a tale to tell on this as it goes down the line.
Yeah. Okay.
And I have to add to that, because the way Phil ended it was right on with the cost, because I know we keep talking about costs, but ultimately it does get shifted to the reliable payer source, which is the private insurance section of healthcare. And so all of this ultimately drives up the cost of insurance for people who have private insurance. And so that kind of goes back to the question at the beginning of all of this is, well, why should I care if I'm not on Medicaid? It's because you, me, and everybody else, we're going to end up paying for those cuts.
Okay. So this is partly coming from the federal government, partly coming from the state government. There are, I understand, complicated formulas for different things. And I realize we're diving into the territory of we don't know, but hypothetically, if Medicaid is cut at the federal level, could the state make up for that?
That's the $30,000 question, Jared. Right? Do you have any intel on that?
I would actually say it's the $331 million.
I was wondering if that number was right.
I was being a little facetious, right? Yeah.
Say that number again, Jared.
It would be right around $330 million. And let me quantify that a little better, qualify it. So, you know, we do actually know. We know that at the federal level and in Congress, in the House, they have agreed on a cut target of $880 billion. And that cut target is through a process that's called reconciliation. So it's a special budget process that's used in Congress. And they have assigned the House Energy and Commerce Committee to come up with specific ideas on how to achieve $880 billion in cuts, specifically in Medicare and Medicaid. Now, all signs point to the cuts would have to come from Medicaid predominantly. So we actually do have a map that's telling us that this will happen. It has to happen if the budget's going to pass. And if you start working within that $880 billion, that's a large number. And there's only so many fiscal levers you can pull to come up with that. And so one of the fiscal levers we're very concerned about is Medicaid expansion. Medicaid expansion is a portion of the population that's covered under Medicaid, and the federal government pays, generally speaking, about 90% of what it costs for that population. So the federal government for our Medicaid program covers 90%, and the state pays 10% for this special population of around 72,000 Alaskans. Now, if that were to roll back, which has been contemplated at the federal level very seriously, then you would talk about shifting the burden to the state. Instead of paying 90%, the federal government might want to go down to our floor match, which is 50%. So if the feds say, hey, we're going to roll this back and we're going to only cover half of Medicaid expansion, you cover the rest, that means we'd have to come up with $330 million to keep coverage for those 72,000 people. And considering what we're all talking about at the State House about our budget, that's a really hard figure to reconcile with our fiscal situation.
Have you had conversations with state legislators?
Yes, we have. Our job at this point has been to understand what is being considered and try and explain what it would actually look like in Alaska. And that's why I've kind of illustrated with these numbers. We have shared that with legislators. We've also talked about some of the other cuts that have been contemplated to show how serious it is. And we've also communicated this directly to the Alaska Congressional delegation to alert them that this would not work for us. It would be catastrophic, not only for the healthcare system, for Alaskans across our entire state.
I'm curious how you are both preparing in the face of all these unknowns.
Yeah, I mean, that's a fair question. It's in right now. I'm quantifying the amount of Medicaid revenue that hits our facility, which is $6,700,000 last year. Probably 60% of that is long-term care, and then it's split across ER, primary care, inpatient, outpatient services. So with that number, I wouldn't know how to forecast anything until I know where they're cutting and which services would be impacted, and then we would come together and get a strategy together related to that. Fortunately, our hospital is a critical access hospital, which is Medicare as well. So provided that doesn't get cut, there's some opportunities there that maybe we can look at and work with our CFO and our team with. So the first step is, though, knowing how much revenue we're talking about, what's the shortfall of the budget, in which services and staff would be impacted related to that.
Okay. And Jared, did you want to add anything there?
Yeah, we just talked about one cut scenario, Medicaid expansion, because it's something that's been talked about a lot at the congressional level. There are so many other variables that come into play and possibilities, very real possibilities. It wouldn't be just one thing and done. So like Phil said, in trying to forecast, we're also quantifying. We haven't even talked about the enhanced premium tax credits that 28,000 Alaskans use to purchase their private insurance on the federal marketplace, and those expiring at the end of the calendar year, and how that will lead to premiums doubling or tripling, which is going to result in more loss of coverage.
You're talking about the Affordable Care Act there?
Yeah. Yes. We haven't talked about there's a low-volume Medicare adjustment program that's set to expire in 2 weeks absent, or at the end of March, absent congressional action. So there are so many things in play, and if you follow it really closely, last night there were some encouraging statements made by the U.S. Speaker of the House that they are not interested in trying to roll back federal match on Medicaid. The problem is, if they're not interested in doing that, I don't know where else they would possibly find $880 billion in cuts. So we're just on high alert and trying to analyze everything and share that information, and not in a shocking way, but a productive way with decision makers.
Yeah, it's exactly right. We just got to be on high alert. I mean, we, without knowing and not having a good budget or forecast, you know, we don't want to, you know, have a high alarm or high alert for, mm-hmm. for nothing, or fear-based kind of system. We just got to be as reactive and be nimble and be flexible. And I feel like that's our strength here at PMC.
Right. Well, I want to pivot just a little bit because, Brandy Boggs, you're here because you have a four classes. These are related, however, because they are looking at the way that the relationship to Medicaid planning can set people up to go into long-term care. And Phil, you had mentioned long-term care as one of the possible areas affected by those Medicaid cuts. Brandy, can you talk a little bit about how Medicaid and long-term care are linked, how those are connected?
So just for the population listening, when we talk about long-term care needs, when I'm talking about that for our presentations, this is an opportunity for folks to think about what their long-term plan for services is as they age. So not just our long-term care unit, but home and community-based services that, you know, we are trying to get into the community, our assisted living, memory care centers that are in our region. So it's a broad spectrum of what long-term care services are. So most folks just kind of go straight to that kind of nursing home level of care and long-term care. But I want people to kind of broaden that out and think about all of the services. But they're all related to Medicaid. So our assisted living, you know, is paid by many folks up there have the Medicaid waiver. So that is a Medicaid program that pays for the services they get in assisted living. Our long-term care unit, of course, people can be qualified and get paid for their services there. And our home and community-based services, our home health department is, you know, able to bill Medicaid for their services. Our adult day program is run through a Medicaid-based you know, program. So it all is intertwined and it all is very complicated. But my takeaway from what has recently occurred is that these planning sessions are more important than ever. You know, we are very strong at being creative and supportive, and that's what I want people to really start thinking about is how do I plan for my long-term care needs, whatever that looks like for them. And that's really why we're putting this on.
And I remember last time you had workshops here in Petersburg, you were on PMC Live as well, and you were saying that you need to start planning quite a bit ahead, because if you or a family member find yourself in a place where you do need that care, you can't do it in a month. You have to have, I don't remember what the buffer was, but it was, you know, a year or buffer or something. So you have to very much plan ahead to make sure that all of your assets have been taken care of in a way that then you will be eligible for Medicaid.
Yeah. And I think the initial presentations that I did in October and November were just a broad overview of what long-term care Medicaid looks like, what, you know, just some strategies. I focused on these Medicaid asset protection trusts because they're the ones that take the longest to set up. Medicaid has a 60-month look back, so 5 years. And so it's important for folks to really, in their middle ages, start really thinking about what do I want, how do I want to protect my assets? And now more than ever, it's important to plan. Like we need to, you know, hunker down and kind of plan what our life is going to look like. And these sessions hopefully will help folks do that. And so I started with trust because they do require, they don't require a ton of time to set up, but Medicaid will look back those 5 years. And so once that 5-year mark is over, then Medicaid won't penalize you for setting that trust up to protect your assets.
So when you say a 5-year look back, basically what that means is you need to have prepared all of your assets, et cetera, 5 years before the person with those assets might need that care.
Some of your assets, yes.
Okay.
Yes.
Okay. And then what happens if somebody needs long-term care and they haven't done that? What happens to their assets? What's the sort of situation?
Well, the situation is it turns into a crisis planning situation. And that's really unfortunate because it really limits the person and their support or their family with really what they can do with their assets. And that's why it's so important to plan, because you have independence and choice when you choose to plan, and you lose those a little bit when you end up in a crisis situation. So it's important to plan so you get those independent choices.
So does that mean that they would have to just get rid of some of their assets in order to qualify for Medicaid?
Yeah, it would mean that. I mean, there are some immediate smaller strategies that you most certainly can put into place. But for folks that have, you know, worked their life and they have a retirement and they have, maybe a second home, some other things, those are things that we want to protect. We want to pass those on to our, who we want to inherit those, whether it be charities or families. That's the important part of planning, because that gives you the choice to do that. When we hit a crisis, you lose those choices. You have a few choices, but you most certainly don't have the spectrum that you would if you just sat down and drafted a quick plan.
Okay. And Phil, you had mentioned long-term care as one of the areas that could be affected by Medicaid cuts. What could that potentially look like? If there are Medicaid cuts, would the amount of people able to stay at long-term care's assisted living be reduced? Hypotheticals, I know.
Yeah, but. I mean, well, we're bound by regulation. We're not allowed to, kick people out, which we wouldn't do anyway. But we would just have to adjust. And what that adjustment looks like, I couldn't tell you until I know what lands. I didn't even want to propose scenarios at this point.
Yeah.
Because of that.
Okay. And Brandy, you're saying that in this particular moment with all of those unknowns about federal funding, it's more important than ever to plan.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I'm an advocate of planning anyway, but really, this is affording us an opportunity to look at our situation and plan out what our long-term care needs are going to be, because we're all going to need them. The statistics are staggering for who needs long-term care services, whatever that looks like for you, but it's almost nearly every one of us. So we really should think about it and start planning.
And I remember you told me last time that there is nobody in Petersburg who could possibly afford stay at long-term care because it's so expensive.
It is expensive, and it's not just Petersburg. Alaska in general, of course, has very high long-term care and assisted living costs. And people should, planning will also help you stay in your home and community. If your goal is to stay in your home, then let's start planning for that. And we can identify those support services. If, you do need to go to our assisted living or our long-term care, you can stay in your community. And that's important. And that's another right that you reserve when you plan.
Yeah.
And so that's why it's really important. And we are so lucky to have all three services currently that we can offer folks in our community.
Yeah. Well, unfortunately, we have gone over time. I want to note the times of those sessions. These are all at the Dorothy Engel Conference Room at Petersburg Medical Center. You have one today from 5:30 to 7. Another on March 1st, which unfortunately I can't see the calendar, but yes, Saturday. That's from 3 to 4. One on March 7th from 5:30 to 7. I believe that is
a Friday.
Next Friday. Thank you. And then next Saturday, March 8th from 3 until 4:30. I'm assuming folks need to sign up for these ahead of time?
No. Nope. You can just drop in. Okay. I have some handouts. We'll go through a PowerPoint. We'll answer questions. And then there will be some more as the year goes on, just other strategies.
Okay. Excellent. And if folks missed the first class, are they going to be totally confused by the second class?
No, and we can answer questions. And okay. If someone's interested in that first presentation, I'm happy to pass it on.
Wonderful.
And answer questions.
All right. Thank you all so much for joining me today.
Yeah.
Thank you. Right.
Thank you so much.
Absolutely. Coming up next, we are going to have Street Beat hosted by Steve Berry.